And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, everyone. It's Dean Haglund from the offices, sub-offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of Los Feliz on a cloudy afternoon. And this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with your co-host, Mr. Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Dean Haglund. I am actually in the post-production offices.
Yes, not the sub.
Of Rational Exuberance, where some technical work was going on today to upgrade our post-production equipment.
Yes.
It was full of sound and fury and amounted to nothing. So that's the first correction.
Hooray.
Post-production facilities where now editorial is underway for a documentary project called Hell Gigs.
Yeah, well, very excited about that.
And where, interestingly enough, even though it's the post-production facilities, pre-production is underway for The Truth Is Out There Parts 2 and 3.
Wow.
Because, of course, much of the pre-production work is based on going through the
old footage.
The footage we've already shot.
Right, the hundreds of hours.
For both Truth Is Out There Ancient Mysteries and Truth Is Out There Business As Usual.
Right.
The other thing I would like to point out to you is it's not actually a cloudy afternoon. It's 10 in the morning.
You know, when you get up at 4 a.m. like I do, by the time this rolls around, it feels like 4 in the afternoon.
We changed the clocks yesterday.
Oh, yes. And sprung forward.
And it's always a little bit unnerving, that first full morning, how long it stays dark.
No. Well, I get up in the dark, so it's never unnerving.
I know.
When you
It's never unnerving. No, I think it's always unnerving.
Right, getting up in the dark?
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, and feeling like sleep is over. That's, I mean, what are you, a farmer?
I am. I'm a farmer of great ideas. And I got a new crop coming up, my friend.
And sometimes field is fallow.
Fallow, like you wouldn't believe. But it's, you know, with fallow, every season there's a fallow. You gotta rotate your crops, and there's gotta be a fallow season for the next season to be nutrient rich. That's my metaphor for today.
That was a good one.
Well, thank you. What a week it's been. Crazy live events. Crazy movie events. Because you know what I went and saw. Nina Bausch in 3D, come on.
So we're not going to have any structure to today's show whatsoever.
Not at all. No, I want to talk right about
it. What a crazy week.
What a crazy week. And I saw Nina Bausch. I saw the documentary that you
all
loved.
Right. Okay, Oscar-nominated documentary, my number one film on the top 10 list, Pina, a 3D. You saw it in 3D?
I saw it in 3D at the Independent.
At the Downtown Independent, in your backyard.
My backyard.
And from the great German director Wim Wenders, talk to me.
Well, here's the thing. I had known Pina's choreography as my days in modern dance in university in Canada would attest. I've seen many a Pina Bausch production, two or three of them. I thought the choreography that he picked was some of her least impressive, believe it or not. The giant square room where they come up, and men and women sort of dressed to do formal dancing. That formal dancing one.
You mean with the chairs? The dance with the chairs?
Not the cafe with the chairs being thrown out of the way, but the other dance.
Oh.
Where they were all just lined up against the wall. I'd seen that one done before, too, and I was shocked that
But the importance of this one was not about the choreography so much as the diversity in the casting.
Yes, and that was right. And so I had never seen it with three age groups like that.
Yeah.
And so that was fascinating. But I thought if we're talking about Pina and her choreography, she had developed a much more innovative choreography that would have lent itself even more to 3D than...
Although she picked the pieces.
Did she?
Yeah, remember, she died 2 days into filming.
I didn't know she picked all the pieces. I assume that Wim Wenders went and made an editorial decision on which pieces to do, because it seemed that some of them did not lend themselves to three-dimensionality as much as I thought it would.
I thought it all did, because the use of three-dimensionality was to create the space and distance between. Yes. Which is the thing that you never get in dance on screen.
Right.
It's the proximal relationships between people. And of course, it's the distance and the space that is so often the most telling thing about the relationship that you're witnessing.
Absolutely. And I would suggest to you that I've seen live events where there were more compelling uses of three-dimensionality than what was chosen there. And if it was Pina's decision 2 days before she died, 2 days into filming, then I'm shocked that she didn't choose some other things. That's all. Other than that, it was enjoyable. I thought they would have gone more into her processes of how she worked.
But they did, because they went into the processes of every individual dancer, and all of them spoke about...
In 20 years, all she said to me were two words.
But that's part of her process.
I know.
Woody Allen doesn't say anything more to actors in a film.
It's true. But my point being that the process of actually coming up and doing a gesture score and how that all came together on Pina's end would have been more fascinating to me, as opposed to hearing it from the dancer's end. But
you would have liked to hear it from her end.
Yeah.
Even though she's dead. Yeah.
Well, I assumed, yeah, the 2 days into it, you would have shot her out first.
See, I would argue to you that a better way to reveal an artist's process is for other artists to talk about it through their work. Lee McCloskey and I have discussed this a lot. There is nothing less interesting than one artist talking about another artist's process.
Right.
So
that's what the movie was, though.
It wasn't. It was them talking about their own process and revealing Pina's process through their own process, filtering someone else's art through their own art. Hmm. That's the real conversation that, by the way, is taking place. That is what we do.
Yeah, but I didn't see
that. And when you don't have the person as the voice of their own process, that's the only, in fact, it's the most respectful way to do it.
But what you saw is them talking about the process. I only heard them speaking of their anxieties and fears and working with a genius like Pina Bausch.
Because any artist on the planet not named Dean Hagland is motivated to be an artist because of anxieties and fear.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not joy and joie de vivre?
And the lack of...
In French?
Of any marketable corporate skills whatsoever.
Yeah, that. Do I have that? I have corporate skills, but I'm not going to talk about them. Anyway, so other than that, the best use of 3D... I've seen, and I'm going to put it to the test when I go see John Carter in 3D right after this podcast.
So. I think by the time this podcast is over, John Carter won't be in theaters anymore. I mean, this podcast is going to go an hour. John Carter showing at the local cinemas at 12, 2, 4, and 6. Refunds for John Carter being given at 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9. No, look, I have said this about John Carter, and for all of you who may not know what John Carter is. The largest single write-off in the history of the motion picture industry, apparently.
Is it written off already?
Yeah, they're already...
They're already walking away
from it. It cost $250 million to make. And it begs the question, what the fuck happened to the Pixar brain trust? Is Steve Jobs' death, is his long illness and the death responsible? I mean, because you've got...
Well, this had to be in development long before that. But.
Right, but of course, this is Andrew Stanton, who did WALL-E most recently. This is his first live-action film. And this is on the heels of Pixar's last animated film, which was Cars...
Three?
Cars 2.
Yeah.
Right? Which was their first truly awful...
Yes.
...film. And then you've got Brad Bird, of course, who did The Incredibles, who did do a very good movie, which was Mission Impossible 4. But again, if they're moving...
Into live action.
Live action. If we're talking about their accomplishment in the last year was a good live action film that was the third sequel in a series...
Right.
...that was established by other people, what is going to happen for Pixar? Anyway, with John Carter, I must say that I actually do want to see it, provided I don't have to pay to see it. And it really feels to me like what Flash Gordon and Clash of the Titans were 30 years ago,
yeah.
which were films that were actually pretty darn cool, but bland leads, especially. Bland lead actors lent for a lack of buzz leading up to the release,
true.
A lack of, you know, enthusiasm from test audiences and from critics, and therefore led to lackluster box office performance at best. In the case of Flash Gordon, truly, well, I don't know, one of those two, I looked this up over the weekend, one of those was really a box office disaster, the other was a box office disappointment. I don't want to
say. I would think Flash Gordon was the disaster.
But 30 years later, of course, both beloved.
Right.
And indeed, in the case of Clash of the Titans, remade and now a new franchise.
Yeah.
Started based on it.
Absolutely.
So 30 years from now, might John Carter, and it seems to me to have the look and feel of something that years down the road, once the pressure of its budget, also, whenever you have a film where it is released publicly, that it had a 28-day reshoot.
Yes.
People just line up to pile on.
To pile on that disaster.
Again, and that's just process.
That's process. That's exactly it. Think about Titanic with James Cameron, how that was supposed to be a Christmas release, and then it became a summer release because he was reshooting so
much. And then it became a Christmas release.
And then it became a Christmas release again because he kept reshooting and had so much production delays and problems. And everybody started piling on. This was going to be a $400 million disaster on James Cameron thing. And then it knocked it out of the park at being the, you know, in the top 10 movies of all time.
Well, it was the biggest hit of all time at that point.
At that point. But my point being about John Carter also is that the comic book it's based on from the Edgar Rice Burroughs, yes. He wrote this in his little hut up in Tarzana. Was originally John Carter from Mars, or the Princess from Mars. And I'm wondering, is it probably unfortunate that we know too much about Mars now to actually be excited about some guy going to Mars to fight an alien civilization? Because, you know, then you're going to change the planet. Is it John Carter of Europa? Like, what other planet in our solar system might have an entire alien battle species
that I don't know.
The
I mean,
human has to go and help.
It just, again, for me, it just comes back to the lead actors, you know, it just being so bland. I mean, this Taylor Kitsch, first of all, if there's a worse name
than Kitsch,
we got to get Taylor Kitsch and Colleen Camp in a movie together.
I need Kitschy and Campy. remember when they were used to change the studios would change actors' names? Them like Archibald Leach became Cary Grant.
Yeah, and now Archibald Leach would actually be a much better name than Taylor Kitsch.
I know. I want to change my name to Archibald Leach. No, just as a ironic.
You actually do have kind of an Archibald Leach thing going on.
I do.
And I have quite a Cary Grant thing going on. So it's
zinger.
You know, I saw several movies, and one of them actually qualifies as the Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
How is that possible?
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
It's possible because the film in question was the first ever feature-length comedy film.
Right. By Charlie Chaplin.
Well, it was by Mack Sennett. By Mack Sennett. 1914's Tilly's Punctured Romance.
Yes, hilarious.
Starring Marie Dressler in her first screen role.
Yes.
Most legendary, one of the most legendary stage performers of the turn of the century, who was fairly mature and quite a large woman by the time she appeared on screen. So right out of the gate, there is a comedic heft gained from how miscast she is in the role of Tilly, which she had originated on stage many, many years earlier.
I did not know that she did that.
So, anyway, Marie Dressler is the lead. Charlie Chaplin is
the love suitor,
the suitor who also has another woman on the side,
Mabel Normand,
who would become, of course, one of the biggest
comedies female stars,
film stars, until a series of scandals in 1923 and 24 derailed her career, and of course also the recurrence of tuberculosis, which killed her in 1930. Right. Irony of ironies that she was so much younger than Marie Dressler, and yet not only would Marie Dressler outlive her, but 2 years after Mabel Normand dies, Marie Dressler is the biggest box office draw of the sound era.
How bizarre is that?
You know, Marie Dressler from 1928 to 1932 had this run of incredible films, not the least of which was Dinner for Eight.
Of course.
So it's a six-reel silent.
Yeah.
And indeed broken up into reels with
stops
that lets you know that the reels are
being changed.
Now, this is the live event of the week because it was part of UCLA Live at Royce Hall.
Very nice.
And it was accompanied by Dr. Stephen Ball. Uh-huh. I believe the only man ever to get a doctorate in silent film accompaniment, silent film music.
Well, because, yes, there's not a lot, of work for those guys anymore, what with the talkies and all. And they trained from the older guys. You know, I had seen many LA Conservancy last remaining seats in downtown LA where they had the old 97-year-old guys who still played piano when they were 12 years old to accompany the silent films when they were originally screened. And those, as they were the last five or six of them existed, they started training younger kids, as they say, to learn how to improvise and work with the screen images as they played.
Right. Now, Dr. Ball had written a score. He wrote three quarters of the score for this film. He was actually able to find some original cue sheets for Tilly's Punctured Romance.
Wow.
But three quarters of the score were original. He, looking at my notes, he is the first person ever to get a doctorate in organ performance.
Right.
He was a Fulbright scholar. He's on staff at University of Michigan. That's his home base, I guess. He travels around the world, doing these performances with great silent films.
I think I saw him Halloween night do Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Lionel Barrymore on the big silent screen. And he was at Disney Hall, and so he had the giant the pipe organ that has all the pipes that are of wood. I think the wood's from Wisconsin, and they look like McDonald's French fry package because the pipes are all in like a seemingly random array on the backstage. And as he was playing when the final murder happened, he laid down all the bass notes, like with everything. Like he basically threw his body onto the entire keyboard with his feet on full pedals to get the full bass effect. Blew you out of your seat. It was awesome.
It was really interesting at UCLA because the organ, what you think of as the organ, the instrument that he's sitting at and playing, is just the remote control.
Right.
Because the actual instrument, the pipe organ, are built into the ceiling above, something like 15 tons built in above the stage
right
at Royce Hall.
And those are the pipes that are like blasting the yeah. music that reverberate through your seats.
And of course, fun to see the film at UCLA.
Was it getting big laughs?
Fun to see it with an audience where it gets big laughs, big laughs today.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. And fun to see it at UCLA where it was restored, after all.
From their UCLA Restoration Society.
The archives, the film archives. Yeah. And it's fascinating how many of these films are lost, and we'll talk a little bit about lost films later on.
Right.
One of the things that actually delighted me the most was, given our conversation last week, I believe it was, about the Bechdel test, about all these films, contemporary films that failed to pass the Bechdel test, especially even Oscar-nominated films that failed. And this, of course, was the test that determines the quality of women's roles in the movies.
Right.
By determining how many films have at least one scene where two women or more, but but at least two women have a scene together where they talk about something other than men.
Right. And that almost move the plot forward.
And almost no movies have even one scene of such a thing. True. The only two that we could find Oscar-nominated films that had really such a thing. Well, we thought Bridesmaids, we forgot Bridesmaids wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. So right. There was only one Best Picture nominee that had such a thing. Out of the nine best films, women are such a minority class in movies that only The Help had such a scene. But the very first ever screen comedy did in fact have such a scene. I guess spoiler alert, maybe, well, I don't know.
You haven't seen it since 1914.
But the ending, the very last scene, is between Marie Dressler and Mabel Normand.
That's right.
And they form a friendship. And again, it's silent, but they are speaking to each other.
Right.
And the meaning of that comes through loud and clear. And it has been after the removal of Chaplin from the plot. And so you know that it's actually a conversation about their friendship and not about the man that had come between them.
Right.
And so it passed. The very first comedy passed the test. And here we are, 100 years later.
Still haven't moved forward.
We've moved backwards.
Oh, yes.
Arguably, we've moved backwards.
Technically.
So I love that. Well, and we have moved backwards in terms of, when you think about it, the status of women in the movies. I mean, how many box office draws were there in the silent era that were women?
True. There's even that's...
We mentioned two, but...
Dorothy Bainbridge...
Mary Pickford. Clara Bow.
I'm thinking Claudette... And then the great Russian silent film star who had the villa down by
Garbo?
Sunset. No, before Garbo. Her name was Russian name.
I sprung that on you. But the point is that it was much more equal in terms of men and women in the silent film era.
Yeah.
And even in the 30s, really.
True.
So that was very interesting for me to see. Now, I saw a few other films and can't stop viewing now these movies through the prism
of Bechdel.
Of the Bechdel test.
That's hilarious.
I saw two, I guess we'll call them both romantic comedies.
Okay. Which are neither romantic nor funny.
Wanderlust, starring
and Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. And they go to a hippie colony.
From the team that did Hot Wet American Summer.
Oh, yeah,
Hot Wet. You know, which is a big cult success.
Right.
And I also saw Friends with Kids from writer-director star Jennifer Westfeldt, who I'd never watched 24, so I had not seen her in anything in I think, 10 years since Kissing Jessica Stein, in which she starred and wrote, but which was directed by someone else.
Right.
So I saw these two romantic comedies, and again, failures of the Bechdel test.
Over and over again.
Right, because any conversation between women is still about men.
Right.
In the case of Friends with Kids, it's either about men in the form of the baby or the baby daddy. Friends with Kids, getting pretty good reviews. It's got a very nice cast. It's got basically the whole cast of Bridesmaids, and Adam Scott and Jennifer Westfeldt.
Okay.
Jennifer Westfeldt is John Hamm's wife, and so John Hamm is in it along with Kristen Wiig, and the romantic lead from Bridesmaids is in it with the best friend from Maya Rudolph, right, from Bridesmaids.
Oh, yeah, Maya Rudolph, yeah.
So there's three couples upon which the film focuses, and it's getting pretty good reviews. And boy,
fun?
I couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
It's not really funny. It's like it's shot like a sitcom, staged like a sitcom.
Oh.
I guess it's getting pretty good reviews because the actors are good. We know they are good. They have all done really good work in other things. So there is a certain sheen of quality to it.
Right.
It reminds me a little bit of Woody Allen before Woody Allen started pumping out some really bad movies where he was still able to ride just on the reputation and a few good gags enough. Whereas Wanderlust has gotten pretty much bad reviews and it doesn't work, and yet it is really funny at times. So if you ask me which I liked more, I would say Wanderlust, because it was never, sure, it was never real. It never had a chance to really work.
As it were.
But it's really funny. It really made me laugh. There are sequences that are hilarious.
Okay.
And so I liked it more than the film that, okay, yeah, I guess it works.
As a story.
But it's not funny.
Not funny. And that's the thing. When do you sacrifice? There's, in the sitcom world, there's Jokestein and story, what is Jokestein and story Dracula? I forget how that works. But one is, you got writers who can punch out the jokes, and then you got writers who drive story, and it's rare that the two writers are the same person.
Interesting.
If he is in a sitcom world, then he's like, he's golden, because he can do the jokes and he can drive the story. And so you find this now bleeding over into films, where you either have a bunch of a screenwriter who is a story guy or a screenwriter who's a joke guy. And that joke guy is going to lay down and sacrifice story for hilarity, and or the other way around. So I think you saw probably one of each.
Now, here's my question about romantic comedy. I mean, is this a dying genre? The word romantic is an important part of romantic comedy.
Right.
Maybe we ought to just change it to relationship comedy, which is not necessarily the same thing and
that's
which
right.
can be a lot more interesting.
That's true.
But the romantic element of it, you know, this whole story of there needs to be an obstacle keeping these people apart. What might be the difference between a romantic classic and a romantic comedy? And when I mean classic, I mean... I don't mean great. I guess I should say romantic drama. Let's say romantic drama and a romantic comedy.
Right.
Well, in the drama, they don't get together at the end. They're kept apart. In the comedy, they get together in the end, right?
Casablanca would be a comedy if she stayed.
It actually would.
It would be kind
of. It would, because it would fly in the face of everything that they've said.
Right.
About the problems of two little people don't matter.
Right.
But maybe they do.
Let's stick around and find out.
Yes, and interesting that you bring up Casablanca, because Roger Ebert, some 30 years ago, I think it was, wrote about romantic films being an endangered species because it was impossible in a contemporary age to have a romantic story.
Right.
Because the obstacles that come between people in a modern age are no longer romantic. And I don't want to, I'm going to bastardize absolutely everything that he wrote, but what I remember from it, so please don't necessarily think that I'm quoting Ebert, but what I remembered from it, what I took away from it as a young film student, was this idea that the historically in romantic films, be they comedy or drama, the elements that were keeping the people apart were about things much larger than themselves.
Sociological, family, right? Family tearing them apart, be it Romeo and Juliet. That
right.
This is two families that were
social
fighting.
Fabric in some way.
In some way.
In the case of Casablanca, of course, war.
War.
World War II.
Absolutely.
And
a lot of time it was just improprietary, you know, it's improper for a single man who's, you know, supposed to marry that woman to go with this woman sort of thing.
Now, in the modern age, I would say that we still have the ability probably to find dramatic stories that are romantic because people who love each other could be kept apart because of their own sense of priority and their own idealism.
Right.
I think you can find those stories in the world.
But then they seem superficial if their career...
Then that lends it towards comedy.
Right.
Right? But again, if it's superficial, it's not romantic. For it to be romantic, it has to be based on some sense of an ideal that is larger than yourself. It can't
right.
be superficial. So, I think you can find those stories for dramas. There is enough going on in this world that people who care about this world and what's going on in it could commit themselves to interacting with the world in such a way that could prevent romantic interpersonal satisfaction. Mm. So you could find dramatic stories. I'm not saying it's easy, but I do say the world allows for it.
Okay.
But for romantic comedy, I don't know.
That is tough because you are not...
Because it gets back to, if it's going to be overcome, then it almost does make whatever the concerns were superficial.
Right. And by today's things, anything that you find... I mean, we are in such a quick release of any obstacle to overcome it, that you're not going to make a two-hour movie out of that.
Well, and perhaps the obstacles that were overcome in romantic comedies involved social conventions, mm-hmm. rules.
Right.
The obstacles in romantic dramas were social ideals, which are not
right.
rules.
They're
they
not...
speak to the better nature of our humanity, which is what makes the films all the more romantic.
Yes.
Ultimately, Casablanca is not a story of lost love. It's a story about regained idealism.
Right. That this is...
Through sacrificing personal gratification and love, one achieves something higher.
Right.
So that's what makes it such a romantic film. The romantic comedy, traditionally, most rewardingly, love was the reward
at the
for
end.
Finally breaking a social convention that really wasn't serving anymore, but don't kid yourself, had a great deal of power.
Right.
To dictate people's actions.
Right. And what now would anybody believe would have any kind
exactly.
of social power?
It gets back to things like you said, like career rules, yeah. corporate rules, things like these, which are such superficial.
I know. I watched that Drew Barrymore, what's-his-face, the Mac guy in that romantic comedy where she gets a job in San Francisco. He's in New York. And they have trouble hooking up. And so she's like, dude, get on a plane or get a web design job and move to San Francisco and you design your web page from, you telecommute. Like, to me, the whole 2 hours of them screwing around and like missing flights and airports and stuff like that seemed so forced that I'm sure that's why nobody, I can't even think of the name of the movie.
And it's almost, I think also, in addition to the attempt to constantly market for teenagers, over the last 20, 30 years, it also, another reason why more and more supposedly romantic films are made
retro
about young people is because everything for young people feels like a big deal. Because when emotions right. and experiences are new, they constantly seem bigger.
Right.
Because there's nothing to measure it against.
Of course.
And so it becomes easier for a storyteller.
To make it bigger.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems that the obstacle, that the boy loses girl part, second act, is the one thing that you're going to force that's going to stretch the credulity of anything.
What you hated about, if we can say,
yes.
Mulder and Scully getting together, if I may put words into your
Please
mouth,
do.
In I Want to Believe, is almost for you, it killed the romantic nature of the story.
Absolutely.
Because what brought them together so much was exactly what kept them apart, which was their idealism.
Idealism. They're both idealistics that seemingly are opposite, and yet respectively, mutually.
The respect that was born out of that idealism
right.
is the same respect that kept them apart.
Absolutely. And then to have them together, then say negated.
And you felt that when they got together, it somehow was now disrespectful. That's where I took issue to, because it was, to me, a logical progression. Them getting together was a logical progression, and I do believe the two people in similar circumstances would end up together. However, what I do think is an interesting case, though, is it might not be romantic.
Right. Well, that's the thing.
Two people getting together is not romantic.
Right.
Unless, again, in the case of classic romantic comedies, they are overcoming something that many of us face, that doesn't serve us, i.e. society rules that keep people out of...
So then let's look at X-Files 2 in that scene where they wake up in the cabin and she's up and then he just pops up in the bed beside him.
You want to look at that right now? I've got it on DVD. We can just yeah, pop it in.
Should we watch it?
No. But it might interrupt our viewing of the Twin Peaks pilot.
I thought you forgot about that. Crap. Anyway, nothing could be more pedestrian than that relationship.
Boy, I didn't even anticipate that we would talk this much about
romantic
comedies.
I know.
Hey, I also saw another Oscar-nominated documentary.
Which one?
I saw Helen Back Again.
Oh, yeah, the one I voted for thinking that would win.
Yeah, and...
what was that one?
This was... This cinematographer, this filmmaker was embedded with a platoon in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the sergeant... in this platoon on his last day in service got wounded.
Ugh.
And I'm not sure. And then the filmmaker became embedded with him back at home to see his reintegration into society. So it's, of course, something like that's going to be interesting. There are some sequences of filmmaking that are incredible. There's one sequence that cuts back and forth because it goes back and forth in time between the challenges he faces here and the challenges he faced in Afghanistan. There. And there's one part in particular where he's playing
Tour of Duty?
Tour of Duty, I think. Call of Duty or
Call
something.
Call of Duty, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's playing one of those games, and it's cutting back and forth between that and
his actual fighting,
going into a village to secure a village. And the footage is identical.
And that's the thing.
So there's some great stuff. Some people don't like the movie because the main character himself is the lead figure is not necessarily an easy guy to like or whatever. But again, there are myriad stories that can be told out of any kind of conflict,
right,
such as this. And is it a worthwhile film? Yes. Is it a film that I would necessarily recommend? No, and I have felt a great deal of dissatisfaction with many of the films that... have come out of contemporary
war
documentary films, I guess I should say, because of course Hurt Locker was extraordinary.
Right.
So this is one case where by choosing to focus on one man, the film may have really limited its impact.
Ah, interesting. Should have expanded that outwards, maybe.
It might have been better served to have done that.
Speaking of live events of the week, though, who saw Plácido Domingo live on stage?
See, again, this could have been talked about in live events of the week.
Well, you jumped right over
that. So another Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Plácido Domingo and Simon Boccanegra. Excellent. Thank you.
Where did you see it?
At the LA Opera. I even tweeted about it. I go,
how did
this guy bring it on a Sunday afternoon? And somebody replied to it going, because he's Plácido Domingo and you're not. It's like, well, that's not really my question. I was thinking, like, what is his exercise regime and how does he actually, as a man of his age, grind, like, it's a full 2-hour production and it's him on stage almost the whole time.
Wow.
And nailing every note on a Sunday afternoon. He could be, sitting by the pool deck getting a massage, but...
Dean Haglund, what are you reading?
I'm still on, Sam Stone's vampire novel that she gave me.
Right.
And then also Ugly American. I'm reading that book that was given to me by a fan at one of the conventions, said you should read this. And I just started that as well. As well as finishing off Titian by Dan Hudson.
I finished A Positively Final Appearance, Alec Guinness's... final collection of his diary, 2-year period.
Anti-Star Wars diatribe?
I wouldn't call it anti-Star Wars, I would call it pro-culture. And
huzzah!
Speaking of Star Wars, did you see that Topher Grace cut an 85-minute version of the Star Wars prequel trilogy?
No.
He cut all 3 films plus some stuff from one of the series into an 85-minute version of the entire arc. Of Anakin to Darth Vader that supposedly makes a lot more narrative sense and has a lot richer character development and is a lot more action-packed than the trilogy itself.
Is that right?
No one will ever see it because except his friends because it would take George Lucas's permission for it ever to be exhibited. I think the obvious point to be drawn from this is that Topher Grace has a lot of time on his hands.
I guess so. How the hell does he sit down to an edit bay and just...
He wanted to teach himself how to edit, and that's admirable.
Right, very good.
And he's a huge Star Wars fan. On the other hand, I wanted to teach myself how to edit, so I made a movie. Anyway, right, that people could see.
Right. He made a movie where he threw up his own nose, so I don't know if you really want to see that.
So, anyway.
He wants to learn how to edit. He could have cut that scene.
I don't know if we'll ever get a chance to see that. I want to talk about some films that I know we'll never get a chance to see.
Okay.
But I got a lot of reading done. I went out of town, got a lot of reading done. I read the essay from the 1850s by Frederick Bastiat called The Law, which is really about the origins of law and about the reasons we have law and what the legal system ought to be about, which is preserving liberty.
Right.
And about how his fear in the 1850s that it was being perverted around the world to usurp liberties from one group in the name of another. And he constantly held up America as the example that used the legal system to its highest ideal, with two exceptions. One was slavery, and I forget what the other one was. Mm. But indeed, this is 10 years before the Civil War, which of course would disturb Mr. Bastiat to no end.
Right.
But it's fascinating reading and really incredible reading for our contemporary age. And it's hard to read a book like this without thinking that if government is going to address the problems that face us in contemporary culture, perhaps the first order of business is to strip away as many laws as possible.
Right.
Go to every law that was, and that one of the real hindrances to the legal system is not just greed, trying to get the legal system to work for you, which we see a lot, but also philanthropy. Trying to get the legal system to work for others.
Right.
The legal system should not be working for anyone. It should be protecting
everyone.
And so it was a fascinating read. And I look forward to maybe reading it again every few years.
That's awesome.
I read, speaking of books given to us, I read a book by L.E. Baker. We know her better as Louise, George Baker's wife, George Baker of Shockerfest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
His wife wrote a book, Symbiosis, a sci-fi novel.
Oh, cool.
And I read that.
Did you enjoy it?
She had given it to me quite some time ago, and it's always fun to read what our friends have done. We have very
Symbiosis.
Talented friends. Symbiosis. It's a sci-fi novel set on a starship.
Where symbiotic relationships happen?
Well, there's a planet. Think Alien meets Star Trek meets Alien. I don't know.
Okay, so I put the two ends.
Meet aliens.
Aliens.
Yeah.
This is part two. Okay. Sounds good.
What else? What else? Oh, I've been reading a book of poetry, which can't really fit into my 25 pages a day, because you can't just...
Can't rush through the poetry.
Right. You need to read poetry several times, poems several times. You have to read them aloud to really be able to grok them.
Right.
And appreciate them. But I'm reading Wallace Stevens' The Palm at the End of the Mind, Selected Poems and a Play by Wallace Stevens. This guy was fantastic. One of our only poets, maybe, who was really not only accomplished, but rewarded within his lifetime, honored within his lifetime as a poet, but who also kept his work as a poetry completely separate and hidden from his day job, which was as an insurance salesman, I believe it was.
Really?
He didn't let anyone know that he was the poet.
Oh, really?
Because he didn't want either to be judged in context of the
right.
other. It was truly this and that without weaving the two together. Finally, I've started reading... because it's been on my it had collected so much dust, I've started reading David McCullough's John Adams.
Oh my gosh.
Biography,
and the whole thing.
And this is so good. You know, we talk about in culture a lot, we talk about it in The Truth is Out There, and we will in future installments of The Truth is Out There, how a lot of times history is written by the victors.
Yes.
But maybe they are the victors sometimes because they're the best writers.
Ah, ha, ha, ha. Well done.
Because I gotta say, obviously, certainly I haven't read nearly as many of these kind of books as our producer Lyle Scozzi did in and since even The Truth Is Out There, but also leading up to and during Truth Is Out There. But many books that take a revisionist approach to history are really poorly written.
Uh-huh. Because there's an agenda.
Well, I don't know.
Right.
Maybe because they're not writers.
Okay.
Maybe because they are about... It reminds me of what Pliskin wrote to us about how everybody, who, you know, when we would criticize Avatar, and some people would say, oh, yeah, but it's got a really great message, doesn't it? You know, be careful of defending something based on its message alone. Because there's a word for something that is told specifically to get a message across. It's propaganda.
That's right.
As opposed to a work of art.
Right.
So, anyway, David McCullough's John Adams is an extraordinary, extraordinary piece.
Fantastic.
So much fun.
Awesome.
There was an article this week called, from IO9, the website IO9.
I don't know IO9.
And it was a list of weird and wonderful films we'll never get to see because prints don't exist, because of legal issues, you know, et cetera. And it is a fantastic, fantastic article.
Wow.
And I will just share with you a couple of these films because, indeed, you know, the we'll give a link and people can check this out.
Okay.
But how about the first found footage movie ever made, Imgagi, from 1930, a precursor to King Kong?
What?
And it was involved a group of explorers encountering an ancient tribe who sacrificed women to gigantic gorillas. And it was made purporting itself to be a documentary.
Oh.
It lied. And said it was a documentary, that they'd found this footage and put this together.
I didn't realize they were doing that far back.
The film was a box office smash
really, at
the time of its release, but ran into a whirlwind of legal troubles when audiences recognized that one of the African natives had come from Central Casting, and they challenged its authenticity. The MPPDA, the precursor of the Motion Picture Association of America, ordered the distributor to cease all distribution. There were all these different lawsuits that came that ended up burying the film and then ended up having the film be destroyed.
Wow.
And yet it was a smash, and it was the first found footage film.
Now, that's interesting that there was a claim to be authentic. So that's a claim to authenticity for a documentary to have that has since... I don't think anybody's ever... needed that claim to be true. I suppose there's libel laws still, but I can't imagine anywhere in today's society where you would go, wait, Blair Witch Project is not real? I demand a lawsuit.
Right, right.
You know.
Now, many of these on their list, or several, sadly, several are, of course, silent films.
That are long gone.
That you'll never get a chance to see. One of these, The Strange Case of Captain Ramper.
I love it.
Marooned on an ice floe, Captain Ramper, Paul Wagner, mutates into a hairy beast. Eventually rescued by a whaling ship, he is now regarded as a species of polar ape and sold to a sideshow. Treated brutally under his new ownership, Ramper finds kindness in a girl named Tony and a visiting doctor who restores his speech with throat surgery. Once Ramper's true identity is revealed, he receives tremendous financial compensation from the government and leaves the circus, taking Tony with him. Disgusted, though, by modern living, Ramper returns to the Arctic.
Ah, how romantic. Now that's a romantic comedy.
Anyway, I mean, it was supposed to be terrible, according to critics of the time, but it just seems so odd.
That's such an odd movie.
Wouldn't you wish that you could see it?
I know.
Two more really quick. One from the 1960s, made by arguably one of the handful of most famous humans to have walked the planet in the 20th century. Batman Dracula, 1964. Thought to be the first campy portrayal of Batman, Andy Warhol directed the film without the permission of DC Comics.
Of course.
This is why it can never
be
seen. And only showed it at his own exhibitions. Warhol's friend, the appropriately named Gregory Batcock, played Batman, while baby Jane Holzer played baby Catwoman. While the film itself is unavailable, some scenes are shown in the documentary Jack Smith and the Destruction of Atlantis, and you can find snippets of it on YouTube.
Really?
And the poster for it, though, which is super cool, and the stills from it actually have Warhol as Batman and Nico as Robin.
Wow.
In the picture. And they're very, very cool things.
That's pretty cool.
Finally, something. How about something fairly modern?
That I'll never see?
That you'll never get to see. Let me try to find this. It's from 1977.
Topher Grace's Star Wars. No.
1975. Who-Man. H-U-Man. Not okay. Human.
Not human.
Who-Man. An actor, Terrence Stamp. The great Terrence Stamp, playing himself, is placed in a series of dangerous situations while his fear is broadcast to the television audience.
Called Fear Factor.
Their emotional reactions determine whether he is sent into the future or the past. Directed by Jerome Lapurusa and co-starring Jean Moreau, Who-Man won the Trieste Festival of Science Fiction Films, but has strangely fallen into obscurity, and apparently no prints exist.
What about the negative? Surely they must have stuck it in a vault somewhere in a basement.
You never know. I mean, this stuff gets destroyed fairly quickly.
Well, I guess so.
So anyway, so I'll post a link to this, but these are some weird and wonderful movies that you'll never get
wow.
to see. I guess we should probably talk about a couple of celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Where should we start?
I would like to begin, since we do make live events such an important part of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Yes.
Richard Gilman, a drama and literary critic whose elegant, contentious voice resonated through four decades.
For which publication?
Well, he, as a critic, he wrote, I guess probably most famously for Newsweek and before that at Commonweal. And as a critic specifically, he was one of the real champions of the iconoclastic and the cryptic, such as directors like Peter Brook, Joseph Chaykin, Jerzy Grotowski, and playwrights like Harold Pinter and Peter Handke.
Yeah.
So he was a real champion of those, an early champion of these seminal figures in stage, and really consistently dismissed and disdained naturalistic commercial fare found on Broadway.
Ah, right.
Because he found it very constricting to humanity.
Interesting.
But he was equally important, I think, and earned many admirers and enemies through his work as a professor at the Yale School of Drama and as an author of five books of criticism and his own memoirs. He wrote in the late 70s. He died at 83 in his home in Japan. He himself once wrote, he said, "I don't think of myself as a critic or teacher either, but simply, and at the obvious risk of disingenuousness, as someone who teaches, writes drama criticism, and other things, and feels that the American compulsion to take your identity from your profession with its corollary of only one trade to a practitioner
right.
may be a convenience to society, but is burdensome to the individual."
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more as inventor, producer, writer, actor, cartoonist.
I thought you would appreciate that. Also,
I am not in what I do.
Also died this past week, songwriter Robert Sherman, probably best known for penning such infectious Disney songs as It's a Small World, After
yes,
All.
That's right.
And Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
And the non-Disney Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
He died in London at age 86,
mm-hmm.
Accumulated in his lifetime a bevy of awards, including two Oscars, a Grammy, received many more nominations, and along with his brother Richard Sherman, they were known, by the way, as the Sherman Brothers.
That's how we identify them.
They were honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame
right.
in 1976. And they were featured in a retrospective album released in the 90s by Disney titled The Sherman Brothers, Disney's Supercalifragilistic Songwriting Team.
Ah, how nice.
So we remember.
Remember those. And who could forget, since we were talking about Star Wars all through the show, Star Wars, the conceptual artist who designed Darth Vader's helmet, R2-D2, and Ralph McQuarrie, the great artist who did the original Star Wars concept art, passed away at 82 last week.
Okay, so, we've been talking a lot about movies. We've got a few minutes left here. I give you choice.
Okay.
As you are a visitor here to the post-production offices of
I never
Rational
show up here.
Exuberance, I give you a choice. Do we talk about the Chilpak Hollywood development news that's been building up? Do we talk about Chilpak Hollywood lawsuit of the week that we did not get to last week either?
Gosh.
Or do we answer a question from our lovely listener, Ulrika?
Wow. You know, I'm going to go with Ulrika because it's been a while since we've answered some
since listening. Last week.
Yes, since last week. So that's been a while.
She called our attention to an article that, again, film critic, journalist, writer Neil Gabler wrote in the LA Times.
Yes.
And indeed, it would take a young woman in Germany to call our attention to something in the LA Times because no one in this city, especially in the industry, reads the LA Times.
I look at it online, but I understand they're putting up a paywall. So,
but do you even look at the entertainment page? You don't, right?
No.
Because we read maybe the trades.
Or the Wrap or Hollywood Deadline.
Wiretap and certainly Deadline. Yeah. But anyway, it was an article that basically proposed the psychology that Hollywood doesn't like itself or what it's doing right now, or how it's doing it. And so it looks fondly to yesteryear, and this is why the rewarding of
the
films
artist.
Like the artist Hugo Warhorse, even, which not only was an older story, but was made like a film. You know, Spielberg made Warhorse as if it was made in the era
of the 1920s.
You know, the 20s, but the way that Disney would have made these films, you know,
way back when,
post-war, yeah.
Yes, and it's so funny that you should ask that because I actually sat down with the Canadian titan in the book publishing industry who has walked away from it all, and he's going to start a publishing firm where only the writers can communicate through correspondence. You actually have to send in handwritten manuscripts and you write letters to each other, and this is how you negotiate book deals because all of this email and stuff like that distracts and distorts our mind. So I would think that that is probably true, that the actual, that we have given short shrift to the actual process of filmmaking, so much so that now the genie in the bottle that everyone tries to capture, we don't even have the bottle anymore to capture a genie. We've lost all smoke and mirrors in the process of storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I understand what you're saying, so much ingenuity was applied where technology is applied now.
Right.
And that is ingenuity of a type, but it's ingenuity that is separated from the creative individuals who are tasked with making the film in the moment.
Right.
And so there was something about the ingenuity that went into making it real within the camera.
Within the camera. You understood like a camera lens film.
And doesn't it make sense then that Spielberg would want to do something like that with Warhorse? Because there's got to be a part of him at times that
misses.
Hello, Raiders of the Lost Ark was done in camera.
Yeah.
Compare that to the later Indiana Jones
skulls. Yeah, they were all digital.
Or even the third, you know, Last Crusade. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It just the process changed so much.
Yeah.
And there's got to be part that misses that. I had not thought of that. And you're probably right.
Right. That it's gone to computer software programmers and designers that way.
And also, and this is interesting because this is something that I was writing about in relation to Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries, in sending out the first publicity materials for it and, you know, just informational packets, writing about how as society is speeding up all around us and as we feel greater and greater fear about what the future may hold, we also seem to feel a greater need to connect with the past.
Right.
That by looking backwards and connecting with that inheritance might give us hope moving forward.
That there's a way through this.
If only, not only if there's a way through this, but thinking in terms of filmmakers, but to remind ourselves as we look all around and distribution apparatus are going out of business, companies are dying, ways of doing business, there is death all around us.
Yes.
There are also new births all around us, but we don't know what those mean or what those will look like.
Right.
So we find ourselves connecting to artists who also were starting something new.
Right.
And
didn't know what the future would look like.
So we find inspiration from them, so that hopefully we can meet the fear we face about the future.
Right.
But also, we gain strength by simply reminding ourselves, I think, that we are part of an ongoing story, that we are a link in a chain.
Right.
And that it frees us a little bit of thinking that all the weight is on our shoulders.
Right.
This is a tradition, this is a storytelling tradition that will continue.
Right, that this isn't so much end times as change times.
Yeah.
Which was the argument I had last night with the publishing. He thought it was end times of the culture, that, you know, tweeting will end anybody's ability to write a novel, that we will become illiterate, that we'll work in emoticons, and that all will be lost. Which I told him that this is just the new beginning of storytelling.
You know what I would have done?
What?
I would have LOL'd at it.
And a happy smiley face to your phone.
And that brings us to a conclusion of another installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Thank you, Ulrika. You can find this show.
And every show, almost.
Certainly every show going forward.
Right.
Many of our shows in the past. We're going to add another old show this week.
That'll
from
be
the
fun.
Archives at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. Download and stream the shows. Subscribe via Really Simple Syndication or iTunes. All
yes.
Right there at the site.
Easy.
And read our monthly Movie Lover's Companion.
Movie Lover's Companion. We love that.
And you can write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Like us on Facebook.
Please do.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You can find a blog each and every Sunday previewing the coming week's show on MySpace.
Of all things of MySpace.
MySpace.com/chillpackhollywood.
Yeah.
Follow Dean Hagland on Twitter.
I'm D. Hagland. Follow Phil.
I'm Phil Lernis. And we will see you again next week.
Bye, everyone.
Belated spoiler alert.